The scripture reading this morning is from the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 9. And I'll read the whole chapter for us. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out its seven pillars. She has prepared her meat and mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her maids, and she calls from the highest point of the city. Let all who are simple come in here, she says to those who lack judgment. Come, eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and you will live. Walk in the way of understanding. Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker, he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Instruct a wise man, and he will be wiser still. Teach a righteous man, and he will add to his learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For through me your days will be many, and years will be added to your life. If you are wise, your wisdom will reward you. If you are a mocker, you alone will suffer. The woman folly is loud. She is undisciplined and without knowledge. She sits at the door of her house, on a seat at the highest point of the city, calling out to those who pass by, who go straight on their way, "Let all who are simple come in here," she says to those who lack judgment. Stolen water is sweet. Food eaten in secret is delicious. But little do they know that the dead are there and that her guests are in the depths of the grave. This is God's word.
Thanks be to God.
Well, since Sunday school begins today, let's start with a quiz. The category, famous mentors. When I say the name of a student, see if you can think of the mentor. Luke Skywalker was mentored by Master Yoda. All of the kids are listening. King Arthur was mentored by Merlin. Yeah. The Karate Kid, the original Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi. Here's a harder one. When Odysseus left for the Trojan War, he entrusted his son Telemachus to an aged counselor and friend named anyone? Mentor. And since that time, many of our best stories take up this mentor motif. The Lion King has Rafiki, Harry Potter has Dumbledore, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles have Master Splinter. In each case, the mentor has wisdom that cannot be learned from books. It's hard won from hard lessons in the world. And if the hero wants to be wise, they must learn to listen not to their own untrained heart, but to the voice of the mentor who trains them in discernment. The idea here, the idea behind education, Christian or otherwise, is that you never find wisdom by yourself. You need mentors. You need people who are further along than you on the road of life that can tell you, "I've lived it, and here's what I found," stored up from years of lived experience in the world. Now, our text this morning from the book of Proverbs and the way that Proverbs work are in a similar way to the wisdom of mentors. They don't start with doctrine, redemption, exodus, restoration, but with daily life, where we are. They're rooted in existential questions about the world. What is this place? How do I navigate everyday existence? What does it mean to live well in this world? Because wisdom, according to Proverbs, is about being good at life. In fact, the first 9 chapters of Proverbs are written in the form of parental instruction to a young person who is about to enter adulthood. Words from a father or a mother to a son. It's as if the son is about to move away, about to move out of the formative framework and protection of his home. And so over and over again, these chapters echo with a call for the son to remember what he's learned. Chapter 1, verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. Chapter 2, verse 1. My son, if you receive my words. Chapter 3, my son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. Chapter 4, hear, O son, a father's instruction. Chapter 5, my son, be attentive to wisdom. Chapter 6, my son. Chapter 7, my son. See, the fatherly counsel is meant to prepare a person to step out into a world full of possibilities and full of pitfalls and still be able to live well. Now, our passage this morning, Proverbs 9, is the climax of this opening section of Proverbs, where the fatherly voice describes life as a journey through a city, and wisdom and foolishness are embodied as two women who offer lodging to travelers along the way. And as we read this tale of two women, we realize that we are not just spectators watching somebody else's journey. No, we are the travelers. We are the ones on the road, beset by many voices offering many visions of what is true and beautiful and good. And the art of living well begins with listening well, discerning the voice of wisdom from among a cacophony of other voices, and then deciding to walk in that path. Our weekly practice of listening is meant to train our ears to hear when we leave this place and go out into the wider world. Now, our passage this morning invites us to hear wisdom's call. In fact, its central truth is that wisdom requires a commitment to cultivate our character. Let me say that again. Wisdom requires a commitment to cultivate or to keep cultivating our character. To hear wisdom's call is to choose to become someone worth becoming. A person who takes life seriously, who doesn't take themselves seriously, because most of all, they take God seriously. Because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And because we see God and take God seriously, we strive to find out and follow the grooves of his creation, and that means cultivating our character. So I want to draw out this theme under three headings this morning. First, character comparison. Second, character contrast. And lastly, character cost. So there's a comparison, a contrast, and a cost. Let's take the first. Character comparison. In the first five and last five verses of this chapter, we meet these two characters, wisdom and folly. And they're presented as powerful and attractive women calling to naive subjects to enter into their houses and to share a meal with them. Let me make two observations here. First, notice that neither of these voices are easily ignored. We are told in verse 3, then again in verse 14, that both of these women sit at the highest point in the city. Difficult to miss. Because the idea here is that the only way you will miss either voice is if you make a concerted effort to do so. Both paths must be chosen, and everyone must choose. Second observation is that the invitation of wisdom and folly sound nearly identical, at least in the beginning. In verse 4, wisdom is crying, "Let all who are simple come in here." And then in verse 16, folly is crying, "Let all who are simple come in here." Identical words. Folly mimics wisdom. She says the same thing, giving the appearance that she is offering the same thing that wisdom is offering. Let all who are simple come in here. This makes things tricky. Folly doesn't say, if you are a fool and want to die, then this is the way to go. No, her words have promise and appeal. They even have the ring of truth. They sound like wisdom. And this ought to be disturbing because it indicates that a person can believe themselves to be in the way of wisdom and actually find themselves viciously deceived. In fact, just a few chapters later in Proverbs 14, one of the proverbs will be that there is a way that seems right to a person, but the end of it is death. also reminds me of a caution of a Romanian pastor named Richard Wurmbrand, who writes this: "The language of love and the language of seduction are the same. The one who wishes a girl for a wife and the one who wishes her for only a night both say the words, 'I love you.'" Many voices promise love, life, happiness, wholeness, but they are not all offering the same thing. Now, this is alarming. Neither voice is easily ignored, and both of them seem to be saying the same thing. So how in the world do we distinguish between the voices of these two? Well, the good news is that there are some striking differences to help us tell them apart. This brings us to the second heading, character contrast. See, once we get past this common call, we begin to see these pronounced differences in the way that each of these women are described. First, there's the nature of the invitation. Wisdom draws people through the promise that her feast will be satisfying and fulfilling. In fact, we have this extended soliloquy of all of the things that wisdom will teach you in the middle section of this proverb. Folly, on the other hand, knows that her feast is not satisfying and not filling. But she's able to draw people in nonetheless. She's able to get people to believe that stolen water is sweet when they could have wine. She's able to get people to think that stolen bread will be pleasant when they could have steak. How? Verse 13. The woman Folly is loud. Like the Wizard of Oz, she has smoke and mirrors. To put it another way, her words have no substance, but people listen to her because she puts on a really good show. In 1984, Neil Postman wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And since it was 1984, in the introduction to his book, he compared George Orwell's book, 1984, with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Both of these books were set in the future, from the perspective of the authors at least, and both of them prophesy a dystopian society, a possible future for the present. This is what he writes. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. In 1984, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. And Postman concludes, this book is about the possibility that Huxley, not Orwell, was right. And I think the writer of Proverbs might agree that our problem is not that the voice of wisdom is unavailable, but that the voices of folly are so loud and numerous that wisdom's call gets drowned in the din. The voices of folly echo throughout our culture, calling us to take what is ours, to think only of ourselves, to protect ourselves, to secure ourselves. And the proverbial father reminds the proverbial son that there is another perspective, another voice, another way to live if we would learn to listen. This brings to a second contrast, the way that each of these hosts is described. Wisdom's feast is described as the fruit of patient preparation, while Folly emphasizes the shortcuts that she has taken. Notice how much work precedes Wisdom's invitation in verses 1 through 3. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out its seven pillars. She has prepared her meat. She's mixed her wine. She's set the table. She's sent out her maids to call from the highest point in the city. Wisdom's elaborate preparation is a way of saying this is a quality feast, a Babette's feast for the simple. The finest of meats, the finest of wines. My wife and I were recently in Paris, and we learned that there's a different way of eating that happens over there. Call it slow eating. we have fast food, they have slow eating. Because the idea is that the food is so good that it's meant to be savored. That the conversation, the fellowship of being together at a meal is meant to be savored. It should take at least 2 hours for you to eat this meal. Now look at the contrast here with folly. While wisdom stands, folly sits. Folly has prepared no meat, she's mixed no wine, she's set no table, and she's sent no messengers. And in contrast to wisdom, what kind of food is folly offering? Literally, bread and water. Prison food. And not just bread and water, but stolen bread and water. The point is that the way of wisdom is characterized by what Eugene Peterson has called long obedience in the same direction, slow eating. Whereas the way of folly is characterized by shortcuts and instant gratification, fast food. In fact, while I was writing the sermon, I took a break to read some online news at Yahoo, which I'm not sure is that news anymore. But as I reached the bottom of the webpage, these sponsored ads greeted my eye. Secure your future in just 12 minutes. New steroid alternative, build muscle fast. 2-minute trick to mask thinning hair. How to make any woman obsess over you. Now, I'm not sure why that website's algorithm paired those headlines with me. But the point is that you no longer have to walk through a city to hear folly's voice. It's available with every click of the mouse, with every tap of the smartphone. More than ever before, we are encouraged and enabled to seek quick solutions that require little thought, little effort, little tension, little discomfort. We don't want to do the hard work of cultivating godly character and mortifying sin. We would rather have a religious experience that would make our spiritual lives easier. But the truth is that becoming good at life, in the perspective of Proverbs, becoming wise never, never happens instantaneously. It takes slow eating, long obedience in the same direction, diligence and faithfulness in the little things as well as in the big things. In Proverbs, wisdom is repeatedly described as a path. And one reason is because the only way you get anywhere on a path is by taking one step at a time. A few years ago, I read this book called Born to Run, which tells the story of crazy people who run ultra marathons, which apparently is any marathon over 50 miles. And one of these characters goes by the name Barefoot Ted. Because apparently it's not enough to run these marathons, he also runs them without shoes. And someone asked Barefoot Ted how they could begin to become more like him and run at the level that he runs at. Where do I start? This person wanted to know. And Barefoot Ted answered with 8 words. Right foot, left foot. Right foot, left foot. And that's the perspective of this passage too. That what really makes you who you are, what really takes you somewhere, who you become, whose house you dwell in, your final destiny is basically a product of the little things that you do every day. Right foot, left foot. Right foot, left foot. But these are hard words. Who can hear them? It's much easier to embrace the words of folly. Patience is overrated. Stolen waters are sweet. Take every shortcut. The path of folly is loud and lazy, but there is a cost. This brings us to our third heading, character cost. Look at wisdom's words in verse 6. Leave your simple ways and live. Leave. Leave so that you can live. And walk in the way of understanding. You see, wisdom and folly are calling with the same words to two very different destinations. Wisdom calls to the simple so that they may surrender their simplicity and live. But folly calls the simple to surrender their lives to death. Verse 18 says that those who stop at Folly's house do not know that the dead are there and her guests are in the depths of the grave. Recall Jesus' sobering words from Matthew 7, that the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. But the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. My brothers and sisters, do not mistake loudness for life. There is no ultimate fulfillment in Folly's house, only, as Lewis described, an ever-increasing desire for an ever-diminishing pleasure. Stolen bread is less and less satisfying until you have so glutted yourself on it that you reach the place where nothing tastes. And the path of folly costs everything. But wisdom has a cost, too. The cost of wisdom is commitment. Leave. Leave your simple ways and live, and walk in the way of understanding. See, in Proverbs, the term simple doesn't mean a person who is stupid or unsophisticated. In Proverbs, a simple person is a person who is uncommitted, a person who isn't really sure of the world or their place in it, who they are, who they want to become, who God is, what God's place is. And because of their lack of commitment, they can't make good choices. Proverbs shows us that the worst advice you can give to an uncommitted person is follow your heart. Because a simple person is uncommitted, their desires are disordered, like the person who goes with whatever flow happens to be the strongest. To use the image from Psalm 1, they are not like the tree rooted by the water, but like the chaff that the wind blows around and away. But wisdom requires a commitment to cultivate and to keep cultivating our character. But the unfortunate reality is that often there are few things we are more reluctant to give than commitment. Years ago, I had a meeting with a very bright student who told me that her greatest strength was her love of learning, while her greatest weakness was her inability to commit to anything. And I asked her if she thought the two were related. She said she hadn't thought of it before, but as she reflected, she admitted that her inability to commit does stem from a desire to keep her options open, and the thought that somewhere out there might be an opportunity or experience that she might miss. And so she could not commit. And I think the student is a good picture of our modern situation. On the one hand, we're exposed to more information, more options than ever before. And on the other hand, the glut of information, all of the options now available to us, makes it so hard to commit. And because of this, it makes it very difficult for us to become wise, because wisdom requires commitment. Think of the seminarian who can tell you the five views of any one issue, but is unable to tell you what he himself believes. The cost of wisdom is commitment. There are these two core commitments that drive this passage, that flow naturally from this passage. The first is found in verse 10, the commitment to fear and follow the Lord before anyone else. This commitment, the writer tells us, the father tells us, is the very beginning of wisdom. But second, there's another commitment, a commitment to community. It's not enough to be committed on your own, that character cultivation actually requires community. This is what I think is going on in verses 7 through 9, where one of the key tests of wisdom is how you respond to correction, which then assumes that you are in a community that can correct you, that knows you well enough to correct you. Character cultivation requires community. The father tells the son, "You will never find wisdom by yourself. You need mentors. You need wise counselors. You need fellow travelers. Only the fool says, I know what to do. I can figure this out on my own." The wise person is so unsure of her own wisdom that she craves the insight and experiences of others. And wisdom is paradoxical this way. If you think that you are wise enough on your own, you are probably a fool. But if you know that you need others to speak into your life to cure you of your foolishness, then you might be on the path towards wisdom. I'm taking time on this because I know that many of us value our independence. I certainly do. We like keeping our options open. But I'd like some of us to consider that one of the things that God is calling us to today from this text is to be more committed to community here at Covenant. Do you have a circle of spiritual friends who can walk with you, who can see the real you, to whom you are committed? Are you committed to surrounding yourself with others who can walk with you, in front of you, behind you, on this path of character cultivation? But how shall we do this? Maybe some of us haven't had wise parents or wise mentors. We've had no one to say to us, "Hear, my son, remember, my daughter." Or maybe we have had wise voices, but we've often gone astray. Or at least we hear that other voice calling us to that other way, away from the voice of wisdom. Or all of us have spent too much time in the house of folly. So what is our hope? Well, remember how wisdom's invitation is characterized. She's inviting us to a meal, to come into the house of wisdom and spend some time slow eating, putting down roots. There are relational, if not romantic, overtones in this invitation. This is because wisdom ultimately is not about mastering principles, but a matter of love. It's like the father is saying that the only way to become wise is actually to enter a relationship with wisdom, to move in with wisdom, so to speak, or to welcome wisdom when wisdom knocks on your door and wants to move in with you. And our great hope is that this is true, and not just in a poetic sense, that it is true that wisdom became flesh and moved into our neighborhood, that wisdom walked among us. And if the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, then knowing Jesus Christ is its end, its goal. Jesus, the wisdom of God, that wisdom is all about seeing him, getting to know him, loving him, being loved by him, being changed by that relationship. For when you see Jesus for who he really is, many of the things that you thought were foolish begin to look wise. And many of the things that you thought were wise begin to look foolish. When our eyes are healed and open to reality, when we see Jesus for who he is and what he is doing and what our place is in this world in relationship to him, we become willing to walk a different way. So may we see Jesus today. And may we hear his voice crying out to the uncommitted and to the committed alike, come and see. Come and follow me. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Come to the cross. Come to my table. Leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of understanding. This is a simple invitation. Will you pray with me?